Distinguished Chairperson, Comrade Paulo Jordan, Professor Gavel, Rector of this university, Comrade National Chairperson Oliver Tambo, Comrade Joe Slovo, the Doyen of African Politics, Comrade Azizi Govan Mbeki, Sean and Robin, Comrade Grasa Masher, comrades and friends. Distinguished chairperson decided not to introduce me to you. I am also not satisfied with the introduction made by Comrade Jibiliza. And I therefore decided to introduce myself. I am happy that I'm an employee of the masses. Ten years ago today, whilst I was in Portsmouth prison, I felt shattered and terribly alone when I received the news that Ruth First had been assassinated. My grief was all the more poignant because I knew both of the men injured in the same blast. In my mind's eye, I saw the distinguished chairperson of this gathering, Paolo Jordan, as I had last seen him when during 1948 I spent a few days in his home. Similarly, I could see Comrade Braganza talking intensely to me when we met during my stay in Morocco in 1962. But most clear, I could see Ruth. Ruth engaged in intense debate while we were at Wits University together, who uncompromisingly broke with the privilege of her wealthy background, who readily crossed the racial barrier that so few whites were or still are able to cross. A woman whose passion and compassion enabled others, including those from liberal and conservative perspectives, to play their part. It is a small consolation that her memory lives beyond the grave, that her freedom of spirit infuses many committed to an open society, rigorous intellectual thought, courage, and principled action. Ruth spent her life in the service of the people of Southern Africa. She went to prison for her beliefs. She was murdered because of her acute political acumen, combined with her resolute refusal to abandon her principles. Her life and her death remains the beacon to all who love liberty. Many of you here also knew Ruth personally and will pay fitting tribute to her, as several speakers have already done. But for us, the assassination of Ruth First was not only a personal tragedy of immense proportions, it was part of a pattern of the systematic elimination of leading opponents of apartheid. 10 years later, this commemoration is most appropriate because it is only now that information is beginning to come out about the death squads and the crimes committed in defense of apartheid. Our country cries for peace. But this will be difficult to achieve until there is a recognition of the real causes of the violence and the disbanding of those forces at the center of what is in reality a low-intensity war against the people. The violence is destroying the very fabric of our society, has distinct burdens. Firstly, there is random terror where anyone, irrespective of political affiliation or ethnic origin, can be a victim. This occurs through train massacres, attacks on taxi passengers, revelers in taverns, etc. Secondly, within this random terror, there is the clear pattern of assassination of lower and middle leadership of the mass democratic movement. And this includes those members of the communities working within the peace structures to bring an end to violence. Such assassinations deliberately fuel tensions and generate patterns of revenge killings. Thirdly, there is the systematic assassination of leading political figures, including Ruth First, Jenny and Kat Rain-Schoen, Joe Garby, Matthew Gwenyu, David Webster, and Griffiths and Victoria Mxenge, to name but a few. And through all these layers runs a consistent thread. The South African security forces, who until now have been placed above the law, a gathering such as this should not only pay tribute to those we have lost, but should also focus on how to bring public knowledge what happened, to public knowledge what happened, and what structures still exist so that the violence can be brought to an end. The rampant lawlessness can be seen in the systematic torture by such means as beatings, electric shocks, and the use of hoods to suffocate prisoners, as well as the continued occurrence of deaths in police custody. We are asked to believe that the Muipatong tapes were erased by mistake. But if this is true, the reflection of police incompetence is simple beyond belief. If we accept the argument that the tapes were erased through over-recording, we also have to accept that the police did not know how to use their own equipment. Did not know that they did not have, did not know that they did not know and were completely unaware that they did not have tape recordings of daily routine calls. If we accept this version of how the tapes were erased, we also have to accept a complete lack of accountability, internal reporting, or any system within the police force. Among the revelations we need to pay attention to is that which places former Law and Order Minister Adrian Flock as chairing the State Security Council meeting, which spoke of removing Goniwe from society. We need to relentlessly pursue information on the role of General van der Westhuizen, not in only in relation to the Gonwe murders, but also more generally, especially given his alleged involvement in a recent bid to assassinate Dirk Kutsia in London. This is but the tip of the iceberg, and already government ministers are clamoring for a general amnesty. While we do not in principle oppose a general amnesty, such a matter is the province and the sole responsibility of an interim government. The minority government cannot pardon itself. Furthermore, integral to an amnesty is full revelation of past crimes and who committed them. This is not for the purpose of revenge, but to ensure that we do not carry such festering sores with us into the future. A cleansing process is not simply the granting of pardons. Moreover, endeavors to equate the criminal activities carried out in defense of apartheid with the actions of those who fought to rid our country of this terrible scourge is not helpful. The actions of the French resistance were never comparable to the actions of the occupying German army. The way forward requires cool heads and iron discipline. We welcome the proposed investigation into the South African Defence Force, the South African Police, KwaZulu Police, Umkhonto weSizwe, APLA, and others proposed by the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Boutros Ghali. This investigation into all these forces is to be conducted by Judge Goldstone. Excuse me. This investigation into all these forces is to be conducted by Judge Goldstone and the South African Council of Churches, and we will afford them every assistance. Following from Mr. Vance's visit, the Security Council is meeting today to consider what the next steps should be. There has been a very sympathetic hearing of our request for international monitors to be permanently based in South Africa, and we await a final decision in this regard. We have sent to New York our best negotiator, Comrade Thabo Mbeki, who is there having discussions with the Secretary General of the United Nations and the members of the Security Council. He has done exceptionally well before, and there is no doubt, no reason why we should doubt what he is capable to achieve this time. But the most urgent task facing us is to bring all the security forces under a central command structure, and for control to be placed in the hands of a multi-party commission. All of this is necessary so that we can end the bloodletting and move forward to peace and democracy in South Africa. Let us all play our part. May I, in conclusion, comment on the presence here of Graca Machel, the woman who brought such a famous revolutionary to his knees, Samora Machel. Her presence has a unique significance because her husband, as well as Comrade Ruth First, were killed by agents of the South African security forces. Apart from the enormous assistance which Comrade Samora Machel, the government and the people of Mozambique, gave to us at our moment of need, there is this everlasting link between the two countries. And the presence of Comrade Graca here underscores these bonds. And last but not least, the memory of Ruth First and countless others who died that we may be free lives in our hearts. They will never be forgotten. Thank you.
To harass me at the pass office. You know, the same type of person who stopped me and asked me for a passbook. You know, and I believe that then there's something wrong somewhere. And I changed my attitude. I said, possibly then, you know, it's certain type of thing that has made those type of people I left behind treated in that way. And that was a great experience. And when we started sometimes training with whites, you know, and for instance, I can quote this quite well because they always remain vivid in my mind. You remember these two guys who escaped from prison sometime in the late 70s, early 80s? Kingston, was it? Two guys who escaped from Pretoria prison. They were with Mumbaris. See, they escaped with Mumbaris, the three. They were at the Pretoria Central Prison. They came to us and you know, who had, I mean, I was one of those responsible for their training program. And in this area where we were, it used to rain, it was too damp, and sometimes you would sleep, you know, really under a tree, and it used to be raining. You wake up in the morning, still drenched, and you could, you know, you could hear people coughing almost, as if it's a, choir. And there they were, they were taking it. So, I mean, those type of things, you know, changed my mind. So I say exile, really, it is a plethora, you know, of experience, so sort of a mosaic type of thing, which where you didn't would say, yes, it was bad. I left my family 15 years ago. Of course, I feel that sometimes, you know, if I had been remained here, I don't know what would I still live alive. Would I be what I am? Would I be something better, something lower? That's hypothetical. But the truth is, this is what I've learned from my exile.
You had just said that you...
Of course, I forgot another thing. Is that I realized you could fall in love with a white girl and be happy.
I was going to come to that.
Oh, yes. My first wife was white. Yeah.
So you said you joined the EEC in 1975, and you said you had gone on a major change in political ideas and ideology outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
Can you reconcile this thing? Because I discovered that there's some sort of discrepancy.
No, there's no discrepancy at all. The thing is that, you know, when you're inside the country, sometimes, particularly, I mean, I learned my politics through, you know, SASO, through the BPC, BCM, you know. I learned my poetry, my politics through writing poetry, you know, and, you know, through the Black Consciousness Movement, you know, that protest type of, you know, that color-like, But I realized that the struggle is not only about color, you know, because I used to see everything bad in terms of black and white. You know. But I mean, particularly in my learning of Marxist philosophy, it helped me a lot in understanding this. I'm not a communist, but I've loved to look at things from a Marxist perspective, and I found it very helpful. But I don't think there's a contradiction between, you know, black consciousness and, I mean, having learned my politics through the Black Consciousness Movement and being a member of the ANC and that, and you know, I haven't totally renounced my black consciousness, but my black consciousness is directed. It's not the beta type of black consciousness. I still believe, for instance, that the black consciousness I believe in is should now be transformed in something like affirmative action. Because I believe that if there are to be changes in these countries, there are certain things that should be done, you know, to see those changes.
Just maybe to come to the conclusion of this interview, we'd like to get some information about your family. Said you had just one.
Yeah, I'm divorced, man. I'm divorced. That is as far as I can go about that one. The second one is that I'm married here. My wife is just here in New Street. She's from Ghana. I've got two daughters. Oh, maybe that's not the last one. Not writing anything, so I'm not afraid. Mm-hmm. okay. I've always felt I always felt better when I do interviews to write when I start listening to the tape. Yeah. But how do I say? Start with yours. Well, generally, life was not easy in the camps. I can recall many incidences which are very sad in my life. I think I was just 6 months out of the country. You know, we're doing a special type of training called commando type of training, you know, where you are taught, you are trained in live bullets, where you are trained to kill a person with your bare hands. You don't need a weapon. Where up to now, you know, you can use any weapon that you can find. You don't need to be trained in a particular type of weapon. So, one can operate any weapon from the east or the west. You know, even to know how to manufacture some of the weapons if you are in a pushing situation. And the things are very, very tough. It was a very, very, very difficult training. Actually, people were dying. But fortunately, at that time when we came, we were trained with SWAPO. And some of the comrades already were dying from SWAPO. From bullets and from the food we were eating. I remember one time Slovo came to me to see us. He said we should eat the food that we're eating during the day. So we never used to sleep, you know, because you couldn't sleep. The mosquitoes, you know, used to bite you through your trousers. They're so big mosquitoes, you know. I don't know if some of you have seen them. It's white on top, you know, it's black and it's white. I'm telling you, if it pierces you, it's as if it's a wasp, you know. So in order to get rid of the mosquitoes in the evening, we used to sit around the fire. And Slobo came in with the other members of the leaders to visit us, and so we gave him
blown up on August 17, 1982, I was not like the speakers before me in exile or in jail. I was a conscript in the South African Defence Force. That is why I have no recollection of her death. I cannot remember reading or discussing the event. In white South Africa, it was not big news, I'm afraid. Anyway, at that time, she would have been nothing more to me than another radical failing in her effort to achieve a communist takeover of South Africa. It was a sentiment shared by the vast majority of South Africans at that time. It was only more than 2 years later, one evening in a Pretoria bar, that a South African policeman confessed to me, "We also killed Ruth first," he said. That policeman's name was Captain Dirk Coetzee, former commander of a South African police death squad. That evening, which I remember so well, this man, who killed 7 people and committed 22 other serious crimes as a commander in the South African police, told me that the South African police had been killing anti-apartheid activists. I could hardly believe it. My conservative upbringing in a traditional Afrikaner house in Pretoria had taught me that the South African police was the protector and the guardian of democracy, of Christianity, of civilization. And now suddenly, in 1984, I was told that they are killers. It was a rude awakening for me into South African reality. I remember that Dirk Coetzee mentioned three names to me of people who had been killed by a death squad: Griffiths Mnenge, Tsupiwe Mutumkulu, and Ruth First. At first, these names meant nothing to me. I didn't know who they were or what they had done. I was then a reporter at the Afrikaans Sunday newspaper Rapport, and I remember going to the newspaper's library the next morning and start working through the files looking for those three names. I discovered to my shock and horror that these people did exist and were all killed in very mysterious circumstances. They were killed exactly as Coetzee told me. Mnenge, brutally stabbed to death in November 1981 while returning home from work. Mutumkulu, who mysteriously disappeared in April 1982, shortly after instituting a civil claim against the South African police for having been poisoned in jail. And Ruth First, blown up by a letter bomb in her office at the Center for African Studies. Coetzee told me that he and his askaris of the Section C1 counterinsurgency force based at Vlakplaas had assassinated Mkenge and participated in the disappearance of Ruth First. But he said, in the disappearance of Mutumkulu, I'm sorry, but he said that Ruth First had been killed by their colleagues of Section A of the security police. Section A was the foreign section of the security police and was commanded by Brigadier Piet Goosen, the policeman who was in command of the 1977 interrogation of Steve Biko. Super spy Craig Williamson was also a member of Section A of the security police. Section A was based on its own farm called Daisy, next to Vlakplaas. It was on this farm exactly 10 years ago that Brigadier Goosen and his colleagues manufactured and sent a letter bomb to Ruth First. Shortly after the bomb exploded, Coetzee said that Williamson told him, "We got first." Coetzee said he remembered it was a joyous occasion for the South African police. The men drank beer and brandy and coke, patted each other on the back, and all agreed that they have dealt the enemy a terrific blow. Coetzee was told that an envelope he had stolen 5 years previously at the office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Swaziland had been used to post the letter bomb to First. I have never known Ruth First. I don't know much about her life, her writing, her political thought. But what I do know is that she was murdered by the South African government because she opposed a very evil ideology. Successive National Party governments tried their utmost to silence her. They banned her, they charged her for treason, they detained and interrogated her for 117 days. But in the end, they got to her and many, many other activists. If there is one aspect surrounding the death of Ruth First that stand out, it was the reaction of the media. We are here tonight to, among others, bestow a special award for excellence in journalism. But I'm afraid that the death of Ruth First has led to the most horrendous journalism ever practiced in South Africa. 2 years after her death, the Star, that mouthpiece of English liberalism in South Africa, wrote that Joe Slovo had killed his own wife. The Western diplomatic source they anonymously quoted was none other than Craig Williamson. Joe Slovo sued for defamation in the United Kingdom, and the English judge who presided the case, Mr. Justice Richard Tucker, called it the worst libel he had ever experienced in his entire career, and awarded 125,000 Rand to Slovo. The Star refused to adhere to the jurisdiction of an English court and refused to pay. But the worst was still to come. On April 8, 1988, just after Albie Sachs's arm was blown off by a car bomb we later discovered the CCB had planted, Die Burger's political commentator wrote in a column, and I want to quote it to you in Afrikaans. Toe mevrou Jo Slovo, beter bekend as Ruth First, in Maputo deur 'n briefbom gedood is, is wyd en suid verkondig dat dit Suid-Afrika se werk is. Hoewel in die internasionale veiligheidsgemeenskap redelik algemeen aanvaar word dat dit kolonel Slovo se KGB-metode was om 'n huwelik te beëindig. Die burger wrote that it was Colonel Slovo's KGB method to end a marriage. Standing here before you tonight as a journalist, I can only hang my head in shame for the media's contribution in creating the culture in which atrocities like Ruth's murder could happen. No wonder that my parents, my family, and the vast majority of white South Africans still believe that there was justification in the secret war against people opposed to apartheid. That's why people still ask me today, now what is the fuss about death squads? The police or the military would never have killed innocent people. They must all have been communists. Ruth First did not deserve to die. Neither did many, many other people. Good people, honest people, just people. Just think tonight what contribution towards peace and democracy people like Griffith and Victoria Menenge, Rick Turner, Fabian Ribeiro, Matthew Goniwe, David Webster, Anton Lebovsky, and many other could have made. Many people sitting here with me tonight have been on the death list of the South African police or the South African Defence Force. They planned to kill Oliver Tambo many, many times. Joe Slovo many times. Was once in Maputo at the grave of Ruth First. And yes, the killing continues. We all know that people are dying like flies out there in the township. And yet, when we asked white South Africa on Saturday at Ellis Park for 1 minute silence to think about the dead, they waved the flag and sang this stem. They don't care about black bodies. Life has become cheap. I am not going to try and convince you tonight that the South African government had a policy of eliminating and assassinating political activists. There are ample evidence that the government used death squads in their political campaigns against the black disenfranchised. Previous allegation that all seemed too fantastic to be true has all been proven to be the truth. Death squads, Inkatha Gate, the Trustview massacre and cover-up, the Goniwe signal and many others. All this evidence points to one devastating truth. The South African security forces have become a haven for criminals and thugs. Brutal, cruel people who had for decades killed, tortured, suppressed. People who the government wants us to believe had after February 2nd, 1990, suddenly became our friendly bobbies on the beat. Why then, Mr. de Klerk, are so little or so few political crimes in the township solved? Why had nobody yet been convicted for 39 massacres committed since the middle of 1990? Why was there a cover-up at Trustfeed? Why was the police yet again criticized in the Supreme Court last week for their inability to bring the perpetrators of the Alexandra Vigil massacre to book? Why has this brutally effective force that in the past had the ability to hunt down ANC activists anywhere in Southern Africa became so incapable of stopping violence in the townships? I will tell you why. It is because there still exists a culture in the South African security forces that the ANC and its supporters are the enemy and Inkatha an ally. There is so much evidence that in various incidences the police were standoffish spectators while the Inkatha Freedom Party savagely attacked unsuspecting black people. The SAP even ferried the impis from designated spots to massacre blacks considered to be opposed to Chief Gacha Buthelezi. The Goldstone Commission has condemned Inkatha and its private police force, the KZP, for their complicity in the violence, so has the International Commission of Jurists and Amnesty International. And yet, in a recent study by the Human Sciences Research Council, only 17% of white people said they believed Inkatha was involved in township violence. The Commissioner of Police recently said that the police force is representative of average white South Africans. This is why I say white South African policemen still regard the ANC as the enemy. This, I believe, has a profound impact not only on the quality of policing in South Africa, but on the existence of a so-called third force. I believe that the term third force should be used in its widest sense. Any activities which are intended to or have the effect of increasing the instability of the transition period. Third force activity does not need to be coordinated. There may be many third forces acting in many different ways. I don't have the time tonight to place all the evidence of the existence of a third force before you. But I believe that at the basis of this third force lies the security forces culture I earlier mentioned. It is not only a culture of perceiving the ANC and its allies as the enemy, but it is a culture of being above the law and guarding Christianity against the communist overthrow. Don't tell me that after decades of being indoctrinated and brutalized, South African policemen and soldiers can change overnight. It is because of the existence of this culture that members of the security forces fail to investigate massacres, shoot on people running away, still let people die in custody, and become embroiled in cover-ups. I frequently speak to policemen. Maybe because I'm an Afrikaner, they speak to me. A few weeks ago, I visited a police bar in Pretoria and was yet again shocked by their naked racism, their hatred against the Mandelas, the Tambos, the Slovos, and their commitment to fight the ANC to the bitter end. I believe one of a future government's greatest challenges will be to try and change this culture and in the process avoid more Ruth Firsts, David Websters, Matthew Guniwes. It is going to be a hard and bitter battle. Forget about white people just handing over power. Apologize for the misdeeds of the past and take our hands and walk into a new future. We are going to need strength, commitment and dedication. Remember the memories of those who were detained, banned, forced into exile and ultimately killed. People like Ruth First, don't let her death be in vain. Thank you.
Comrade National Chairperson Oliver Tambo, Comrade Chair Paolo Jordan, Comrade Joe Slovo, Comrade Professor Jake Skirvel, Comrade Ronald Siegel, Comrade Grasa Michelle, Comrade Joe Slovo, did I say?
Yes. Yes.
All the other distinguished guests. It's such an illustrious list that one can't mention everybody. And comrades in this hall. I'm speaking on behalf of the judges of the Ruth First Memorial Prize, the first award of it. The name Ruth First was known to the white South Africans in power and most of the white South African public as that of a political activist and a communist, a prominent protagonist of the Rooi Gevaar, which threatened to take over our unique whites-only democracy in South Africa. Most of the feared changes in our society that Ruth First believed necessary and worked for, and because of which she was banned, locked up in solitary detention for 117 days, and forced into exile, are now recognized as the basis for negotiation between the government and the liberation movement. No matter how much the government attempts to sidestep and deceive and delay the process of freedom through total transformation. Much of what Ruth First saw as necessary for justice to be done against oppression and racism in our country is now the subject of duly constituted official commissions. The law of the land that sent her and others like her to prison is in the process of indicting itself and seeking reformation. The exploitation of workers, the discrimination in education, the economic degradation of the majority of South Africa's people, and the wretched living conditions this brought about. These outlawed concerns that she addressed treasonably then are now international concerns debated for solution in the solemn forums of the outside world, the United Nations, the OAU, the EEC, the Commonwealth, the Congresses and the Parliaments, and many other seats of power dedicated to constitutional justice. This is what the name of Ruth First means as a political activist today. But Ruth First was also a journalist, and I hesitate over the qualification also. I don't know whether her profession was a vocation and her political activism an avocation, or whether this was the other way about. Perhaps this is because the freedom of the press, which she boldly and doggedly asserted in her daily practice of her profession as a journalist, is one of the first principles of liberation in any society. And so vocation and avocation met as one, a single motivation. Perhaps, and again it's a speculation, in a different country, a different society, where bread and shelter and ordinary human dignity were not so brutally and systematically denied the majority of the population, she might have also become a writer of fiction. In her account of life in prison, and much later in her life, her collaboration in a study of the personality and work of Olive Schreiner, in fact, in all her writing, there's a kind of loving eye for significant human detail, a sense of dimension beyond the verifiable fact that suggests the illuminating power of the imagination was always there in her. Whatever else she might have been, she was a superb journalist and editor, and she gave to her profession, as she did to everything else in her tremendously active life, an exacting attention, a relentless intelligence, and that special energy granted to those who are able to put the lives of others before their own. In her 20s, during the mid-1940s, she was already a pioneer in a new kind of journalism, if not new to South Africa, certainly a kind that had been practiced little, if at all, since the far distant time of Thomas Pringle and the middle distant time when Chumbok was flourished briefly by poets led by Plumer and Campbell. And the kind of investigative journalism that Ruth First practiced was far closer to the bone in the body of South African society than its journalistic predecessors had cut and dug. Indeed, dug is a key word with reference to one of the major exposés of her career. She uncovered the infamous Bethel Farm scandal, where black men, some prison labor, clothed in sacks and kept in conditions of slavery, dug potatoes from the earth for the profit of white farmers. She showed the way, established the bold approach to social responsibility in the press that led others in such alternative press as existed in the 40s and early 50s to take up investigative journalism. Henry Nkomalo of Drum was, like her, one of the best and bravest. In the 60s and 70s, mass circulation papers began to do so, led by the Rand Daily Mail. I can't attempt to recount here the history of investigative journalism in recent times in our country, though it certainly merits it. The shutdowns of newspapers in the 80s, such as the Weekly Mail, New Nation, South, and Grassroots, the banning and detention of editors, the punitive action taken against papers such as Freya Weekblad, and the determination of all these to go on publishing is a fine roster and a reason for public gratitude. What must be said is that without the determination and the courage of individual journalists and editors, without in particular the rise of the alternative press, the examination of the horrors, and they are no less of our immediate past and our present. Without the confrontation of the people of South Africa with what we have done and allowed to be done, which the press alone latterly has revealed, there would be no moral basis worth accepting for a negotiated settlement. There have been so many lies, you've just heard some of them, so many cover favors exchanged in the files of high places, so many blanks in the memory of those who give orders from up there, but we depend almost entirely on the press to ensure that the bodies whose assassins go free are not built into the walls of a new South Africa. There are the financial scandals, the education crises, the calvary of people who have moved from station to station of misery as a lingering consequence of group areas, the corruption that drains away public money, the questions of the partiality or impartiality of the police, and currently their criminally lackadaisical want of training, their inefficiency, and their efficiency in producing 13 blank tapes, all of which has come out in print, often in defiance of the laws corollary to censorship that remain with us after restraints on press freedom are supposed to have been banished. But at the present time, and on this day, the 17th of August 1992, I make no apology for emphasizing that the aspect of investigative journalism most insistently on our minds is that of press probes into the unexplained killings of people who believed in and worked for change in South Africa. 10 years ago today, Ruth Thurst was blown to pieces by a letter bomb delivered to her office at the Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo. 10 years have passed, and no one among the forces in South Africa who wanted her dead has been brought to justice. In those 10 years, no one's been brought to justice for the assassinations at home of Guniwe, Tsenge, Webster, and many others. In 10 years, much has changed, but this has not. The murderers are among us, still among us. Without the current exposé of the press, would there be the chance that, at last there seems to be, to find them and to name those who gave them the orders to kill? In this immediate context of Ruth Thurst's unexplained murder as a tragedy in common with those currently being probed by certain newspapers, the inaugural award today of the Ruth Thurst Memorial Prize for Journalism is extraordinarily meaningful, fitting, and timely. What she stood for in journalism is exactly the ethos being followed by journalists who have indefatigably investigated deaths like hers. Not only so that justice be done, but that our society shall face and confess the past so that there may be a different future, something of a clean beginning. I have to tell you that we judges of the prize, Audrey Coleman, Zulaki Sisulu, and myself, found our task and our deliberations both daunting and exhilarating. The portfolios of the journalist candidates covered the years of our immediate history from the mid-80s, and one forgets when so much is happening how much happened before 1990. That watershed of our experience and our thinking. In the material, there was reporting, there were background analyses. In fact, one of the most satisfactory aspects of the portfolio submitted was the follow-up of stories in depth. Reporting of this caliber was not the kind of newsprint to end up lining drawers next day. This was a coherent and continued piecing together of the important issues of our immediate past and our present. Almost without exception, the journalist candidates showed a consistency and perseverance, a meticulous attention to getting the facts, however difficult this might be, a resistance to the padding of speculation on the highest level of their profession. There was ample evidence of devotion to their work that went far beyond deadlines. If they managed to resist partisanship, They certainly were partisan to the objective struggle for the truth, often to be aimed for only at the risk of personal safety. In many instances, an issue opened by one journalist on his newspaper was taken up by another newspaper, with the resultant expansion of informed readership on the issue, and the contribution of another journalist to its investigation. Thus, reading through the portfolios, we could see how a chain of resistance to press censorship and the suppression of free expression was linked. There could be no better time than now for a prize recognizing this achievement to be awarded. Three candidates emerged on the judges' shortlist. One of the judges, Swelaki Sisulu, recused himself from the final decision because among the three was a journalist from his paper. For the two judges remaining on the panel, I can tell you it was difficult indeed for us to make that final decision among the three shortlisted candidates, since all three have outstanding records within the criteria laid down by the Ruth Thirst Memorial, Memorial Trust. The Ruth Thirst Memorial Prize goes to a journalist whose exceptional reporting ranges from exposé of a Renamo deal with Eskom, the involvement of the SADF with train killers, the plan to topple Major General Banta Kholomisa, the evidence of links between Nkata and township hit squads, to the revelation of who signed the death order of Matthew Goniwe and three other Craddock leaders. The winner is 30 years old and was born in Barberton in the Eastern Transvaal. His mother is a South African and his late father was a Mozambican who worked in the South African gold mines. As a result of this connection, he was educated in Mozambique, completing the second year of a BA degree at the Eduardo Mondlane University, but not obtaining the degree as he left to take up a teaching post. In the 80s, he chose to come home to South Africa and, despite his educational qualifications, worked first as an ordinary miner and then as assistant personnel officer at the Rustenburg Platinum Mines before becoming a reporter on education and then a political correspondent on a weekly newspaper. His name is Enoch Alexandra Setoli of the New York. Congratulations on the splendid achievement of one still so young, and we're confident that you will use the prize of 10,000 rand approximately.
To further his development, as a journalist. We also wish to commend highly the two runners-up, the two elements on the list, Joanne Collins and Amy Koff. Both journalists of exceptional ability and courage. We wish to congratulate them. Finally, we should laugh. All those who submitted their portfolios and you applaud the Ruth First Memorial Trust for what
is going to be, for establishing what is going to be a yearly prize, I'm pleased to hear, a prize that in its first year already has proved itself worthy of honouring the great journalist for whom it is named.